This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
When you choose Organic Valley, not only will you be enjoying great-tasting dairy, you'll help to save over 1,600 small organic family farms who are protecting over 400,000 acres of organic farmland and all the plants and animals that call it home. This is dairy you can feel good about. It's great-tasting, high-quality organic dairy, ethically sourced from small organic family farms. To find Organic Valley Dairy near you, visit ov.coop. That's ov.coop.
Greetings and happy whatever day of the week it is that you're listening to this. It's the Nerdist Podcast, episode number 237. Matt and Jonah and I are not only coming to New York Comic Con in October to perform. You can go to Nerdist.com/calendar for that. But we are finally all coming to Toronto to perform in the Just for Laughs Toronto Festival. When I was there in February performing at the Comedy Bar, people were like, when are you going to bring Matt and Jonah? All right, Canadians, it's happening. Toronto. It's happening on September 27th, so you just have to go to JFL42 and get tickets. So do that, and we'll see you in Canada in September. I'd like to thank the sponsor for this episode of the Nerdist Podcast. It's GoToMyPC by Citrix, which, by the way, connects you directly to your Office Mac or PC from any other computer. Also from your iPad or your iPhone with the GoToMyPC app. You can work on any program, any file, any document. It sets up in minutes. You can save stuff. It's fantastic. It just, you know, now that we are a device-heavy culture, finding ways to connect all those devices into one is, I think, pretty dang important. GoToMyPC helps you stay out of the office, particularly in the summer. Let's say you set up one of those frog-shaped plastic shallow pools in the backyard that you bought at the Walmarts, and you left something at your office. Well, you can just access all that stuff now with GoToMyPC, so you don't have to get out of your weird frog pool. And you can just email people and get the files you need right from your backyard. Try GoToMyPC today. There's a special free 30-day trial just for Nerdist listeners. Click the Try It Free button, enter the promo code Nerdist, and then download the free app to your iPad or your iPhone. That is it. GoToMyPC.com, try it free, and enter the promo code Nerdist. This is a very special episode of the Nerdist Podcast. You couldn't do a Nerdist Podcast and not have this guy on. It's Bill Nye, the Science Guy. I am so excited that he came on the show. So excited. We went to the Planetary Society and did this podcast with him. And this is the full unedited interview of what you're going to see from... There's a sliver of the interview on the Nerdist TV show on BBC America this next Saturday, which will be August 4th. We did a salute to science. So we had Bill on, we had Neil deGrasse Tyson on, Cara Santamaria. We had a super, super, super fun show. So that's Saturday, August 4th on BBC America. And this is the full unedited audio. And I would also like to announce, maybe some of you know and some of you don't know, recently Bill Nye did a Reddit AMA and someone said, when are you going to do more Science Guy stuff? And he's like, well, it's sort of tricky, you know, with television and it has to be the right situation. And then someone said, after that, there was a follow-up question, well, maybe you could do something like that on the internet. And then Bill said, stay tuned. And then someone said to me, hey, did you hear that Bill Nye said stay tuned? And I was like, you're assuming that I have nothing to do with that. So I am proud to announce, you guys, that Bill Nye will be coming to the Nerdist channel on YouTube. YouTube.com/Nerdist. I know! Come on! Bill Nye and the Nerdist channel. It had to happen. So we're super excited. In fact, if you go to the Nerdist channel on YouTube right now, there's a short video where Bill Nye teaches me how to tie a bow tie. Because who better to teach you how to tie a bow tie than Bill Nye, who, in my estimation, is the American doctor, if there ever could be one.
Calm down, Whovians. We know there shouldn't be an American doctor.
I'm just saying Bill Nye would be awesome. Also, Bill is having a huge, huge, huge party, Planet Fest, for the Curiosity rover that's landing on Mars August 4th. So go to planetfest.org to get more information on how you can be involved with Planet Fest and possibly get a chance to high-five Bill Nye and celebrate the party on Mars. But right now, let's have a party in your ears with the wonderful Bill Nye the Science Guy here on the Nerds Podcast, episode number 237. This is such a fun episode. I'm freaking out about it. I still can't believe I get to meet some of the people that I meet. So, I don't know. I still nerd out on it. I'm gonna shut up now. Science!
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Right now, it is not to boldly go where no one or no man has gone before. It's to timidly go where 550 people have already been. And that's okay. But that's why the space shuttle had to be retired. And as John Grunsfeld, who's the head of NASA science right now, remarks, we have been to the easy places. And the word easy,
relatively,
8 kilometers a second in low Earth orbit, not trivial, big, giant rocket thing just to do that.
Yeah.
And the moon is relatively easy. The moon is 3 days. You can be weightless for 3 days and not have your bones fall apart. Mars, if you punch it, I mean, if you're just standing on the accelerator, it takes you 9 months, maybe in the best orbital condition, 7 months to get there.
Wow.
And no one knows how yet how to figure out how to survive the radiation. It's not that it's an insurmountable problem, it's just no one's had the resources to have to address it yet. So just keep all this in mind.
Or no one is brave enough to get the superpowers they would undoubtedly get going through the radiation.
That's not a Fantastic Four, I know. Yeah. That
that's one outcome that is about which there's been much speculation, but on a more serious note, when people have nuclear reactors blow up or get inundated by tidal waves, it's actually quite traumatic.
Yeah. We're figuring out problems. This feels like some type of
situation room
where situations... I think we're creating a lot of the situations we're ultimately going to have to solve.
Let's solve space.
All right.
Oh.
Bill, what's one problem of space that we could solve right now at this table?
Right now at this table? Demand...
Mm-hmm.
That somebody build a spaceship big enough to spin,
mm-hmm.
so that we can have
gravity,
artificial gravity, so that our bones will not be will not leave our bodies as we metabolize our food, so which is a problem. People's bones go away in space.
Where do they go? Do they drift through your skin?
No, the density. I don't want to shock you. It goes into your urine.
Oh. Yeah.
So you lose your bone mass.
How are you? I'm not a pee and bone, but other than that.
Yeah, well, but you are. And the people, they do all kinds of exercises trying to stay robust. And there's certain people that think, I saw a talk where they think if they had more impact, they'd be better off. And they've done a study. They have this bicycle as big as this table, and you ride around in this tight circle on a post with wearing special goggles that make you think you're on a highway. Okay.
Wow.
but what we want is a spacecraft that spins, people.
How did they solve the bone density loss in the Star Trek universe, Matthew?
They created gravity.
Yeah, the gravitron.
Which is also my favorite ride at a fair, is the gravitron.
It's the gravitron.
Yeah.
The gravitron, and you can turn upside down.
Yeah, yeah. Not allowed to, but you do it anyway.
Yeah, yeah. What are you going to do? Yeah. The guy's in the middle.
Yeah,
what
he's
going to do?
Gonna try and get
come
to
and
him.
Get me.
Yeah,
punk.
Listen, the carny wants to see you fly off anyway. Yeah. Like, that's the highlight of that
and
guy's
so,
day.
I got to say, the outdoor ones were cooler.
That's true. But they didn't have the radical house music playing.
So you turn upside down, and you're spinning, and there's the lights, and it's a little disorienting, and, but you say you did it.
Yeah, and the fear that one of the purses that the girls put on the middle handlebar will then fly off and hit you.
That'd be so cool.
It would be. Just an explosion of lipstick and perfume. You know,
that's what you think is in there? Just lipstick
and perfume. Yeah, lipstick and perfume and keys to fight off.
That's a mace, probably a mace. People still carry mace around in their purses.
I think they do.
Yeah.
I have to say, with four men sitting here, I think we're not representative of the mace-carrying populace.
Oh, I am. I can't fight. What are you talking about? I carry mace.
What?
My mother's. No, it's fine, you guys.
Well, I carry a CD by mace. And
wow. I have it on thumb drive.
It's funny you were talking about when you were talking about what a rivet counter James Cameron is.
Well, or he associates with them,
right?
With the hardcore.
But when Neil deGrasse Tyson was on the podcast, he had a lot to say about the configuration.
Oh man,
of,
so that's one thing. That's one thing that Cameron's going to upgrade in the new
fix the stars.
Upgraded in the new movie, yeah. But you understand, Neil? I've been with Neil, you know, quite a bit. And, he's really an astronomer. I mean, he looks at the sky, he goes, hey, that's not the, what are you talking about? That's not the Northern Hemisphere. What are you doing? I mean, the way you might look at and say, well, that is a CD. That's not going to play in that DVD player or whatever,
yeah.
Some nerd thing.
Sure.
That's a USB 1. And then you all laugh. So when he looks at the sky, he sees patterns, you know. He's a real deal in that respect. And Cameron makes, you know, he's got the carpet company making the carpet
right.
from the Titanic. And the sky's wrong. I mean, I get Neil's point. What's bigger, carpet, sky? I mean,
he actually had the same 12-year-old immigrant children make the carpet on the Titanic.
They're now 98.
Their grandchildren.
Their grandchildren. Yeah,
guys,
same people.
Weaving, let me tell you, a loom is not trivial.
It's
a difficult thing.
It's not.
You all take carpet patterns for granted. There's a lot of design in there.
I was telling you this before. I just performed in Seattle and performed with John Keister,
John Keister.
Of the Almost Live.
Dear friend of mine,
yeah,
old
yeah.
buddy of mine. Really, he did a lot to advance the science guy's career. I must say, John.
Well, we were talking, and I said, "Oh, I'm going to see you. Know, I'm going to see Bill in a couple."
Then what did he say? I'm sorry. That's what he said, isn't it?
I'm sorry. He's like, I'm sorry. Really?
Do you have mace?
I tried to keep him reined in.
Yeah.
Apparently, they had a device that's supposed to neutralize you that's in the back of your ear, and he said it was faulty. And Bill, oh my God, Bill. But I am interested to hear about.
Sorry. Go ahead. You're interested.
That'd be great if it was like edible glass, like you know, candy glass, and it was just a joke.
It would be funny.
He was just waiting.
There is a much more grounded Wonka vibe, I think, to you that if these were edible, I'd be like, that makes sense. We're the Planetary Society.
Sure.
Why wouldn't they have edible bugs?
They're compostable.
Yeah.
So you were saying?
I was saying, you know, I'm interested to sort of hear, because I know you worked at Boeing.
Yes.
And
I was very well supervised. Don't worry.
Never had to fly a plane.
And but then this really interesting kind of path of, you know, Boeing and working in science and aerodynamics and then going in and then doing and then working in comedy and like being a comedian.
Yes.
And then sort of building this character of mashing these two worlds together, which is just not something that happens very often.
I put my heart and soul into it.
So what tell me a little bit about what you did at Boeing and then we'll kind of.
Well, I worked control systems was my thing, and just tell you, there's an aspect of mechanical engineering called control, or control theory, or control systems, and that was my specialty. And you know, you have a cruise control in your car, you have an oven, which you set the temperature and you go do something else, and it gets to that temperature. So I worked on hydraulic systems, mostly on the horizontal stabilizer. And the
Thank
thing
God.
That, well, this, so you may not have noticed it, but not only, this is the, in Britain, we would say the tailplane. The wing in the back plane thing. Not only does it have an elevator that does this, but the whole thing does this.
Okay.
And there's a giant screw that drives this called, and I'm not kidding, my friends.
Drive screw?
Would but that it were. It is, it carries so much force along linear this way that it has an anti-friction system. And you're very familiar with the anti-friction system. It has ball bearings. Mm-hmm. And this thing is called a ball screw. Mm-hmm. It is a ball screw.
Sounds like a British thing.
And wait, there's more. Back in the day, the big company that supplied Boeing really was the Beaver Ball Screw Company. And I proudly have a couple Beaver Ball Screw artifacts.
Sure, sure.
But you know how this works. You have a surface, you have another surface, and you introduce something round in between them, and it allows one to move over the other without them rubbing or scraping, without very much, dare I say it, tribology.
Is this kind of what they've done with a lot of the buildings in Los Angeles, where they've put them on rollers?
Oh, some rollers and springs, yeah. It's the same. In fact, vibrations and control systems are intimately smoochified. Mm-hmm. The same, dare I say it, second order differential equations control both. So second order is when you have an acceleration, right? So the position is one thing, the rate of change of position is velocity, the rate of change of velocity, that's the acceleration. That's what we're into. That's second order.
And now, is the future of commercial aircraft, like basically carbon...
Plastic.
It's all plastic
planes. Blah. Yeah, so when I worked at 747, it has pieces of what they call depleted uranium. Dead weights on the flaps and ailerons, and not flaps, ailerons, and other control surfaces too. I was kidding. The flap was a joke.
A bunch of mechanical engineers.
It's just hilarious.
I'm sure when I'm driving home, I still won't laugh.
That is rich.
He did the flap bit again.
Oh, God, it's hilarious. Anyway, so you're carrying dead weight around to keep these things stable. So if you can make those things out of carbon fiber... Mm-hmm. Then you don't need as much dead weight. Stable, blah, blah.
Can I hear that, Matt? You can be replaceable.
Thank you.
I also heard that what's gonna happen with a carbon rod? It's like on The Simpsons.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Carbon rod. Is it with these carbon constructions, they'll actually be able to put a little bit of humidity into the environment of the plane, and they won't be so dry. Because now they have to keep it really dry so that the plane doesn't get weighed down with moisture.
That could be. Also, you know, moisture is hard on any metal. Even metal that's, very well protected with zinc chromate.
Yeah.
Even that is...
Kind.
Well, it is that bright green color. Have you ever seen it? Seriously, when the speed brake or thrust reverser comes and you see the green metal... Or under the when the flaps are deployed in the green metal, that's zinc chromate. Goes way back.
Now I know.
It's like, you know, it's a primer. It's aluminum primer. And it's just, to me, as a kid, when I made plastic models of planes and got to paint that color in, I just thought it was the coolest. Yeah. I've grown out of it.
Zinc chromate green. Have you really, though? Have you really grown out of it?
I could quit if I want.
Okay, all right.
just don't want to.
We're here to talk about it. It's okay. It's okay. I'm excited that you got to see.
Yes.
You got to see the Virgin Galactica.
Yes, Galactica.
Galactica. I mean Galactic.
Which, that sounds like the most powerful Virgin in the galaxy.
You saw it. You just tried. You try to get into those pants. You're not getting anywhere.
I'm science uncomfortable. Guy, stop talking about it, please.
Science guy ends career.
You get 40 virgins when you die, or one Virgin Galactica.
Gentlemen, steady.
Did you see?
But there's not. If there is zinc chromate,
yeah.
Now I signed a non-disclosure agreement, but I will say I didn't see any because there's this thing is so much carbon fiber.
All right.
It's a giant plastic plane. It's amazing. It's really trusting the numbers, and it goes back to this guy Bert Rutan. You know, who used to fly around. This still does, I guess, fly around in these planes with the innovative canards in front instead of, you know, speaking of horizontal stabilizer. So, in other words, he had wings to hold the nose up as well as wings to hold him up, kind of thing.
He wasn't the guy that did the...
Still is the guy.
Who was the guy that did the test in the...
Like, 707?
He took the balloon all the way up to the edge of the atmosphere, and there's video of him just, like, leaping out.
Yeah. No, that wasn't Bert Rutan.
Oh, okay.
But I should know that guy's number. He was an Air Force pilot.
Have you ever seen the footage of that?
No.
Yeah, what is it?
And they're doing it again.
Like a suborbital jump or something.
It was in the '50s, I think, or
yeah,
early '60s.
Yeah, it was part of this.
And they kind
of
just wanted to see what would happen, and so he took this balloon, and there's footage of it.
Well, they still do it. I mean, you know the expression halo.
Yeah.
Halo jumps, high altitude, low opening.
Okay.
This is something that the other.
It's in Tomorrow Never Dies. James Bond jumps.
Yeah,
out.
But. They really do it, I guess. But this was in the Cold War, you know, if we're a B-52 and we have to jump out, how hard is it?
And it looked, the footage is amazing because you just see the edge of the atmosphere, and it's just him in a balloon, and then he just crawls up to the edge, and he's in this silver suit, and he just leaps out, and then just like back, and I think, you know, he suffered severe damage to his hand because there was a tear in the suit, and like the cold air got in.
Ouch.
But it's you kind of get that feeling when you're watching it of just like watching him descend through the atmosphere. Like into
when I'm walking across this bridge, I sure hope I don't reach into my pocket and take out my keys and throw them off. I sure hope I don't decide to jump out of this balloon.
Oh God!
We were at the gang here at the planter. So I went to the satellite technology show down here at the Los Angeles Convention Center, and there's a company selling rides, if that's the expression.
Really?
Yeah, you get quite the spacesuit looking suit with the helmet and the faceplate thing, and you go up in a balloon, and then you decide.
Two questions: what does it cost, and can they sew two suits together?
There's a whole thing to have these stretchy spacesuits.
Well, look at them. Looking forward to it.
Hopefully
technology.
Are you
going to
go up?
My diet.
Are you going to go up?
I applied to be an astronaut many times, you know. But after Christy McCullough got killed, I think it changed people like me's relationship to it. Now, you know, to be an astronaut now, they give you a clipboard. How many PhDs do you have?
Right.
A, 100 to 300. It's like the people that become astronauts now really are extraordinary. I mean, we all have special.
Thank you.
Right.
See?
But the
Mom,
people,
see?
But the people that become astronauts now really are achievers.
And so what is ultimately the plan? I mean, I know with Virgin's plan, they're just you kind of just go up, and then you're sort of on the edge.
Well, for 3 minutes, and you see the so-called black sky.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're in outer space. There's a thing we love to talk about, the Kármán limit, which is this relationship of molecules to gravity. You're above that. You know, you're up. So bear in mind that getting that high is this much energy. Getting in orbit is, as a first cut, 9 times that much energy. So this is the beer can problem. Have you ever heard this story?
No.
Beer can. Soda can. Nourishing.
Beer
nourishing,
can if you want to look cool.
Nourishing beverage problem.
Yeah.
So the weight of the liquid in your beverage can compared with the can is about the weight of the fuel compared with the rocket to get in orbit.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So... when you are a designer, a visionary, a great big thinker, and you go, what we need is to take off like a plane, go into orbit, and land like a plane, which would be sexy and cool, yes, not so easy. You need a lot of fuel. You know, the whole thing is heavy. Like a commercial plane is about 10% fuel by weight.
Oh, wow.
A rocket's 90% fuel by weight. I mean, a orbital rocket's 90% fuel by weight. You know, an Estes rocket is somewhat less, or a bottle rocket. And this thing is somewhere in between. But it's what the innovation that these guys have, embracing the future, is making out a material that's much, much lighter weight. I mean, much lighter weight. It's plastic, I'm crying out loud.
How?
Trust me.
How far are we from just regular trips?
Well, this is 200,000 a pop.
Right.
I say this. This is. I'm not in the. I mean, there are acquaintances, friends of the society, but they have almost the Emily's off camera. They have 500 people signed, 450 people signed up. So it's extraordinary, but it's not zero. You know. So the idea is, we saw the hangar. where they want to build plane after plane, spaceship two after spaceship two, and take them all around the world to where the weather's good and fly people up. You know, you go, apparently there'll be a couple 3-day course where you learn to take G's and not panic very much. And then you get a ride. And I guess, I imagine you get some paperwork that says, hey, thanks, Virgin Galactic. You know, take a camera, I imagine. And then it'll become more and more popular. I mean, I just sort of running the numbers. If it costs $200 million to build this thing, let's say it costs $500 million to get it all going.
Yeah.
How many rides would you have to sell at $200,000 to kind of start to break even?
Math.
Yeah, would be 100, you know, 300, 500, not millions and millions.
Yeah.
Right? Just a few thousand, and you'd start to be pulling it off.
That's the thing, is that we need to start selling
podcasts.
Podcasts for like 100,000. Sort of like it's a space for
that you can only listen to on Virgin Galactic flights.
No, but you guys, seriously. Not to get all algebraic on you, but it works the same. I mean, if you invent this software that allows people to charge any purchase to his or her credit card, you get so rich that you can start a solar-powered city, an electric car company, and a rocket company all at once.
Yeah.
You are Elon Musk.
Yeah.
With PayPal. If you can, I mean, it is multiplication. You know, really. It's kind of cool.
I've never met Elon Musk, but
he's
pretty fascinated by that.
He is Tony Stark.
Yeah.
Okay.
He had a cameo in Iron Man too.
Yeah, as he should.
Yeah.
I mean, he's the real deal. I've met him. He's not like my buddy, but I've met him. He is a passionate guy who really thinks about it.
You said
gave
me the table out in the back. You said this was a gift from Elon Musk.
That's a true fact, not a false fact.
The patio table out back.
The patio table and chairs, gift from Elon Musk.
We should get him a table.
We'd love it if you got us a table.
We should get on a table.
Hey, can we talk? We're on camera, right? And you can edit this?
Yeah.
All right, so I'll tell you what we have going.
Okay.
You know who Carl Sagan was, right?
Yes, of course.
So Carl Sagan sat around this table, and by all accounts, he would slam his hand on the table, and you can hear that. Speaking of vibration, it doesn't hurt your hand. It has flexibility.
Yeah.
Furthermore, it's thin enough to amplify the sound a little bit, right?
Yep.
Okay. But the table's a little too small for our staff.
Mm-hmm.
16 people.
Okay.
We have in storage a Marsscape model made by the artist who made the original Marsscapes for Cosmos. Are you with me?
Yeah,
the
with series? You so far.
Yes,
you
yes, with yes, me? Yes.
And we have a guy who designed this fabulous thing. It would have a glass top, wooden frame, and the Marsscape thing would be built in. My recollection is Valles Marineris. Is that right? Yes, I'm getting a nod. And so we'd touch that up with careful, you know, the guy who wears these things, model maker.
Steampunkers.
Janosch from Ghostbusters 2.
Yes.
Yes.
Yep.
Or in
Hellboy. Tony Danza.
Ridley Scott.
Ridley Scott. Blade Runner.
Yes.
The guy who makes the eyes. Okay, then he would touch up the thing, and this glass tabletop would fit over it and it would be wooden around the side, so you'd still have your elbows resting on the low thermal conductivity wood. You know, glass conducts heat so aggressively, it's unpleasant to put your bare arm on.
That's why I say glass couches, they don't breathe in the sun.
They don't.
You're the one?
Yep.
I heard that. I've never tried it.
Where is this table?
It has to be created.
Oh, it's not done yet.
By a great benefactor
who
donated only $3,500 to the Planetary Society.
I'll go in.
This is before.
That's all it would take?
That's all it would take, according to this one guy. So, in my experience in projects like that, sort of double it. Yeah. Okay, but then also while you're here.
2 weeks, bro.
While you're here. Sunday night, April 5th, August 5th, or begins with the
name. My birthday.
August 5th.
Neil Armstrong's birthday also.
Yours?
Yeah.
Way to go, man. We're landing a rover in your honor.
We did it. We did it, everybody.
If you live back east, it's, or farther east, it's Monday morning, August 6th. Except it's in space, so it's So it'll land on Mars. On Mars.
Like John Carter did.
Planet Fest 2012. We would love it if you guys were the mythic lead sponsor.
Yes, we'll do it.
And if you don't want to be lead sponsor, you'll be some kind of sponsor.
Oh, we're going to lead
sponsor. We've got Comet Orbit. We got Levels. We got a party Saturday night. It's going to be turned up to 11. It is going to be, as the kids say, what? Off the hook.
It is off the hook. I think they do say that. Yeah. Yeah,
that's what the kids say.
I don't know.
The kids with their tweeting and their Foursquare and they're crazy.
And they're not subscribing to cable because they watch everything on the internet.
Yeah, the internet because everything should be free.
Yes, at all times. Everything should be free at all times.
No matter how much you put into it, it should be free. So you guys, we would love it if you participated.
Yes, we would love to participate.
It will be a nerd. Out.
Did you design anything on the rover?
You're toying with me, aren't you? The word design. So I was in a meeting over 10 years ago.
Oh my gosh!
Yes.
A decade. The 2000s?
No, it was in the 1990s.
Oh my gosh!
When your Nirvana was still changing music forever, or rock and roll music forever, and yep. The word forever. You know, life is short. So. My father, unlike many of us, had the experience of spending 4 years in prisoner of war camp during World War II. No electricity, no lights, became quite the amateur astronomer. What did I do?
This is my fascinating thing.
Tell us about it.
That's processing.
So you're dead.
So he became fascinated with the stars and sundials. So I grew up with all the sundial stuff. Sundials are around. Pictures of sundials. Bronze casting of the Nye family sundial. Okay. consulting on sundials. Writes a monograph published in the Washington, D.C. newspapers to turn the Washington Monument into a giant sundial.
Okay. That would be incredible.
It'd be fabulous. We have to move the White House a little bit during the winter months.
Who's going to care?
But a symptom of this is you reach a point as a gnomonicist, that one who likes gnomons, mm-hmm. the thing that sticks up on a sundial,
okay.
where everything really should be a sundial.
All right.
Every flagpole, every fire hydrant, somebody should be out there painting our lines. Let's go, people. Every light pole, everything. Let's get on
it. The sundialing of America.
Yes. Mm-hmm. You know where that thing where you have to put your money in for the parking meters
yep.
should be calibrated. Okay. So I'm in this meeting and they have a thing that they point the camera at to get the colors right, the test pattern, the photometric calibration target. Okay.
All right.
And along with this, it has a little post that sticks up and the thing is only, how did you ruin your shirt, Bill? The thing is only this big, and it casts a shadow. And even in here, with any many sources of light, you can see that shadow is yellowish,
yep.
and that shadow is bluish,
yep.
and that shadow is yellowish again.
Okay.
That's from these lights here.
Mm-hmm.
They're not on camera. You can't see them.
But they're here.
I had to run the magic.
Okay, so you use this to look at the color of the sky. On Earth, it's quite blue if you relax your brain on a sunny day and really look. On Mars, it's really orange. So they're planning to send this post all the way to Mars to do nothing but cast a shadow. And as I say, in airplane land, the evil thing is weight. You must never add weight to a plane. That is evil. So they're going to add this thing. What? Come on. Can't we get like an antenna or something? And then, if I may, it hit me. We've got to turn the photometric calibration target into a sundial. Don't you see?
This is the moment.
Yeah, and they're all like, Bill, you know, it's the space program, really. Bill, I see you're wearing a watch. Like, we have clock. No, it'll be cool. We can reckon time. So there are two sundials on Mars now, and the third one is in deep space as we record this.
Wow.
So it's kind of cool. So I wasn't the first guy to suggest it be a sundial. But apparently I was the first guy jumping out of his chair about it. And the other thing that I brought to the party, people, reasonably Northern Hemispherians that we are, temperate yes. latitudians that we are, think of sundials as having a triangle sticking up, right?
Right.
Well, when you're near the equator of a round planet, like Like Earth is
okay.
An example.
Oh, sure. Is Earth. Yeah. Sure.
You don't want a triangle. You want something symmetrical. So if you go to Hawaii or someplace, you'll see they'll have a rectangle sticking up. And it's a little out of your everyday experience if you're from temperate latitudes, but okay. Or a stick. So my dad, apparently for many years, would stick the shovel handle in the dirt in northern China where they were prisoners of war and tell the guards when it was time to eat lunch and stuff. So this is, in English usage, that's called a noon pole. You might call it a pen cap. Anyway, this thing, one thing led to another, and I give you the story because you asked, okay? You brought it on. So there is the third Mars dial, as we whimsically call them, all one word, uppercase M, uppercase D, on the way to Mars. It's kind of cool.
And what's it going to... What?
Oh, so what you do, there are tens of thousands. Emily Lockdewall can probably tell you, there might be 100,000 pictures of the Mars dials, because you use them to get the colors right every day. Oh, the geologists are obsessed with the color of the rocks. This is their thing. And you may look, you may remember the early pictures from Mars were quite, they were too pink.
I got it.
And they coined a, I guess a descriptor, an adjective, over-pinking. It was over, it's a verb. They were over-pinked. So anyway,
that
the color is
a
big
sense.
Deal. But is it is interesting to note.
That isn't. So basically they're going to use... they're going to use the sky casting the shadow as a comparison for...
Oh, yeah. No. Wait, there's more. So there are precisely known rubber things of different gray values. Can I say to the artists here?
Yes.
Color, is it color hue value?
Sure.
Graith, grayness, grayment,
the
grayativity.
The graith of
yeah.
rubber.
Yes, the graith of rubber. And so... Sounds vampirical, doesn't it?
It is. Yeah, that was an Anne Rice book.
So,
then she got all religious.
That's the thing. What is with the vampires in the Catholic Church? I mean, do Buddhists, are Buddhists okay? Are they not affected by vampires?
They're really into mummies.
Oh, yeah. So they have another problem.
Everyone has their thing.
Muslims love werewolves.
They love them.
Yeah. It's an issue. But
and then the Orthodox, the Greek Orthodox, love Frankenstein monsters.
Yeah, it's an issue.
I'm glad you picked up on that. Yeah.
That's where I thought, oh, Frankenstein's monster, yeah. And, okay, I digress. But imagine me digressing. Anyway, so they look at the gray, the rings. It's about this, it's 80 millimeters. This looks to be about 90. But anyway, it's about this big. And they look at the gray with the shadow and they can get the colors precisely right because even now, the cameras on Mars are, if I may, black and white cameras.
Okay.
Because they have more pixels then, and then they put different colored lenses in front of the camera to calibrate the colors precisely, including frequencies that our eyes aren't so good at.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's cool. It's elegant thing, excuse me. And it's involved a lot of math. And a guy who's the president of the board of directors of the Planetary Society, Jim Bell, is the guy who worked all this out, or one of the guys. And he's principal investigator on the calibration target. but the main guy, Steve Squire, said, okay, we're going to put sundials on Mars. This is very cool.
That's fantastic.
It's just kind of cool.
I want to go back to figuring out how you got from Boeing to comedy.
It's really interesting.
Is it like, one night I just went to an open mic, the end?
No. It's sort of. When I was in college, the guy who had been my freshman roommate was still a friend of mine. I went in mechanical aero. He went into material science, into graphite fiber airplanes or whatever.
Okay.
But he had this crazy new thing when we were seniors in college. His house, where he lived with several other people, had cable television.
What?
Yeah, we're like, whoa, dude. And so he said, you got to come over here. Look at this. Look at this. And it was Steve Martin at the boarding house on video, on crude, primitive video. And he goes, look, this guy is just like you. Look at this. So then over a year later, I now have a job at Boeing. I will be frank with you, hanging out at a singles bar.
Okay.
And a different group of friends says, "Wow, you got to enter the Steve Martin lookalike contest." A different, whole different group of people. So there was this convergence. So I entered the Steve Martin lookalike contest, and I won. I did not win the national one. I won the one in Seattle.
You got Steve Martin won that one.
No. The guy who won that was, I guess he still is, from Nashville. He could play the banjo. And I will say, he kind of looked like him, which was a step I wasn't really willing to take. I mean, plastic surgery or whatever. So after that, I started doing stand-up comedy.
Oh, wow. So Steve Martin was, because Steve Martin is my ultimate, like, all the albums and all.
Oh, God. So then, you must have
Born Standing Up.
Born Standing
Up. Of course.
And then my belief about me, okay, my belief about what I did that night was verified to an extent where Steve Martin believed the funniest time is when you decide to laugh. Do you know what I mean? When the guy says, you had to be there. And I claim, and this is an extraordinary claim, and it's only eyewitnesses, there's no video, it was so long ago. I claim that I understood what Steve Martin was driving at in a way that the other contestants didn't. That's my claim. Where you choose to laugh.
Where the audience chooses to laugh.
You see? That's what I'm saying, right there. Yeah, well, yeah, you, the audience member. But anyway, I'm not Steve Martin. I wasn't that good. But I tried, you know, I worked at it. And then, you know, I was a young guy. I was a Big Brother, United Way Big Brother.
Yep.
And I volunteered at the Pacific Science Center in Seattle doing what they called science explaining. I was a science explainer, had a blue vest, mm-hmm. poured liquid nitrogen all over the place. I can still, it's no trouble, I can still chew marshmallows roasted in liquid nitrogen and steam comes out of your nose. And it's funny. I mean, steam. I mean, like, cloud comes out of your nose to here.
I thought you weren't supposed to touch liquid nitrogen.
Oh, no, that's the great thing. It looks so dangerous. But it is, most of what's between you and me is nitrogen. So it is, I mean, and the thing that...
76%, I think.
Are you, what's that guy's name? Sheldon.
Yeah. I'm a Sheldon.
76 sounds high, but I guess that's right.
Is that right? 76% nitrogen?
That sounds a little high, but you might be right. If we include the trace... Okay. So, but I will say to anybody who wants to play with liquid nitrogen, I recommend you don't wear gloves, because if you get the stuff in here or the back of your hand, not what I would know, I've heard, you can really burn yourself. It doesn't get out of the glove. You know? Uh-huh. And the other thing is in your shoes. But the other thing that's never happened to me, but I take precautions, is your eyes.
Right.
If you got it splashed in your eyes, it seems like that would be a drag. But anyway.
you mean to have your eyes shatter into a million pieces?
Oh, what a drag.
The eyes.
Yeah.
The eyes. Was that William Sanderson?
I made your eyes.
Yeah. So along this line, graham crackers are very good. If you eat graham crackers in liquid nitrogen that have been dipped in liquid, it's really good.
But are you just making s'mores with liquid nitrogen and
but
marshmallow?
Exactly. But to me,
a lot of people like to hold them over fire. I use liquid nitrogen.
That's how it went. So the very first Science Guy segment ever, when this is before John Keister was the host of the show, he was only a writer on the show.
Almost Live.
Yes. Was the household uses of liquid nitrogen. Because we all have liquid nitrogen around, of course we do. So this is just some stuff, some tips, you know, like a cooking show. So I shattered an onion, and it makes a sound just like glass. It's really satisfying, you know, cat screech. And then the marshmallows. And you can use graham crackers, as I say, but marshmallows to me are just kind of funnier.
So, but you can, you can't really ingest it, though, can you?
Yeah,
you chew it.
It melts very quickly. Yeah.
In the Iron Chef America kitchen, there is liquid nitrogen in case they want to use it.
Is that what they use? Are Dippin' Dots, like those dots?
Ice cream for the future?
Yep.
Does it have liquid nitrogen? Back in, or dry ice?
I had some of those at the Johnson Space Center in Houston.
Yeah.
The,
and look,
the
he's fun.
Yeah,
I don't feel good, guys. I think it took a couple years, but I'm not feeling that.
That company went out of business.
But I love the idea that you have these two worlds, because I think for any comedian the important thing, or your job as a comedian, is to figure out what do I really want to say, what am I about, like who am I, and you manage to mash those two worlds together.
Yeah, and I tell everybody, I put my heart and soul in it, and this part's documented. I wrote a one-page page that I gave to everybody
one
came to work on the show. And over the years, there were 100 people. There were a bunch of interns and different camera guys, audio guys over the years. And the first thing is the objective of the show was to change the world. And I say, that's what you're trying to do, right? I mean, when you're an actor interacting with other interacting.
Wait a second.
Hey, we're all actors.
My nose is bleeding.
I don't get it. But
oh, I don't know. I just
had it's exploding at a high altitude decompression.
Yeah, exactly.
Decompression.
Exactly.
I get it. Yes, I do.
Coming down from this information trip.
Careful. Steady. Steady. Anyway, you want to get a rise out of the other actor. So when you're a comedian or you have a blog show, what do we call this?
a blog show. No, I'm a stand-up. I know.
Yeah. You want to get the audience, you want to get a rise out of all of them. You want to affect, you want to, I mean, you just look at Chris Rock. Chris Rock is trying to give you something to think about.
Right.
Know? And Bill Maher is just giving you something to think about. I mean, those guys are trying to affect the audience. And so that's what we all do, isn't it?
It is what we all do.
That's
but
what you get up in the morning.
But it was, you know, I think to take this thing that started in a comedy show, but then actually turned it into a real show that actually educated people, but was still, I mean, I think that was a great thing about your show was that it was educational, but I thought it was really funny and great musical parodies.
Oh, God.
I love the musical parodies.
Oh, man. So
some of the best.
It just shows you the importance of leadership. All right. So no, it wasn't me. No, this is it. It wasn't me. I'm not joking. So these three of us did it. Jim McKenna, Aaron's a woman, Aaron Gottlieb and me. We were the three, and I, were the three people that created the show. And Jim and Aaron are just, they're visionaries, man. They just got all these cool ideas. They, like so many people in Seattle, they work at Microsoft as contractors. That's their thing most of the time. That's my understanding from Facebook and emails. All right. But the music video, we did the first one. It was cool, but it was just a lot of work. And everybody goes, well, let's not do the music videos. But this Elizabeth Brock, who was the senior official, like at that time she was, if I can use the expression, my age, she insisted that we have music videos because it engages people. And the guys who wrote those are just the people, the men and women who wrote them. They're just really good. John Sherman went on to be the, it's called story editor, the showrunner of Frasier.
Oh, okay.
He was 21 when he worked on my show. So, speaking of John Sherman, so the thing that happened as time went on, the show was well received, right? The artists would give you permission to use it. And on PBS, you can just do that. You don't have all these clearances, all this, you know, people who don't want things to be free.
Yeah.
Right? But John Sherman wrote the coolest thing for the Sun show. He wrote a video called Bright Corona. But at the time, we could not find the neck.
The neck? What happened to the neck?
Well, apparently they've re-necked. But before, in those days, they had disappeared. I guess they'd all made money and bought Corvettes and were off doing their thing. We couldn't find it. Just even now,
and
I think about that.
Corvettes. Yeah.
And that's one we didn't use. You know, I mean, some of the that Morrissey about Move Me, the Momentum show, those are just great.
I remember
popular.
There was like a Bush song in there, and
and
Crisscross, and
we had Crisscross, weedy rain on the water cycle show, and then we had and then we got, speaking of Chris, Chris Ballew, B-A-L-E-W, I believe, who was the lead singer in the
President of the United States of America.
He said, well, I'll do the song. So he did his own song with different lyrics. Going to the country, gonna eat some farm food. It was cool.
Peaches.
Peaches, yeah.
That's
peaches.
Awesome.
It was good. It was good.
So that show ran, was it 6 years, six seasons?
Depends how you reckon, six seasons.
6 years, like 93 to 90.
Well, 92 to 98, you know.
Yeah.
But so this fall will be the 20th anniversary of the pilot.
Oh, wow.
That's mind-bending.
Wow. I know. So that would mean I'm more than 20 years old.
Oh, my God. Are you okay?
Impossible.
Are you all right?
My nose.
You got it.
But it really, as I say, put my heart and soul into the thing. I'm really gratified that everybody still likes it.
They love it. And there's a whole generation of people who, I mean, when we had the Nerdist Channel launch party, you know, there were a lot of, I mean, like, you know, Rob Zombie was
down there.
At Meltdown.
The W thing.
But when you came in, it was just like, I felt bad for you. It was like, oh my God, like people were just pounding and tugging and pulling.
You have to concentrate.
And then like there were a lot of pictures and I was taking a lot of them myself with you. Like, Bill, just one more picture. Bill, one more picture.
That's, I say, you have to concentrate.
But it was, you know, I mean, yeah.
It's hard. It's hard to smile. You're not getting the audience laughing when they want. Yeah.
But hopefully you do understand.
Well, no, it's very gratifying. And hey, it's my bread and butter, and it's all good. No, bring it on.
How long have you been the director of the Planetary Society?
Oh, I've been director of the Planetary Society.
Are you all right? Your voice just changed.
Yeah, I've been director now for, let me think.
Did you just hit second puberty?
22 months.
22?
That's the way parents talk about videos. He's 22 months.
All the way back to aught 10.
Yeah, well, that's right. Back to aught 10. So, but keep in mind, people, I've been a member for 31 years.
Wow.
Because I'm of a certain age. I had, yes, Bill, we can see. But I had Carl Sagan for astronomy.
You did?
Yeah, I mean, he was my best buddy or anything. I took his class. I did okay. You know, I did okay. And then, because at that time, the state of the art was they sent you, you got on a mailing list, postal mail.
Post? What is that?
It's a technology where you can store information outside of your body.
Is it like mail, but without the E?
Yes, okay. Yes. In
so
fact,
it's
I think the word email. Yes.
Okay.
I think the word email derives.
That sounds really inefficient. Why would anyone do that?
But so you get on a list, and then I thought it was a cool little organization, so I joined. And then when Carl Sagan died, through the success of the Science Guy Show, I was asked to speak at his memorial service in Ithaca, where he was a professor at Cornell.
Yep.
And then I was asked to be on the board because of that, I think. And then I was vice president, and then I left the room a couple years ago, and now I'm on the payroll. Now I'm just
these checks started showing up.
And expectations, but it's all good. So we have 30,000 people around the world who just think space exploration is cool, and we do their bidding. So one thing, we're involved in a couple crazy things. We're making our own spacecraft to get pushed through space by light, a solar sail. Light has no mass. How can it have momentum? It does. Some physics thing. It took a lot of
physics. Was that the official pitch?
Yeah, some physics thing.
Some physics thing, and then
the pointing vector or the consequence of relativity, however you look at it. Anyway, and then we tried to send some microorganisms and some multicellular creatures, the water bears, to Mars. This is my water bear impression.
Oh my God, did you guys just see the water bear that was in
it? Yeah, so, but they are apparently in the Pacific Ocean. The rocket crashed.
And then, I don't know why that footage, man. I don't know why that's
funny. Well, I tried to deliver it in a hilarious way. It does suck. And then a couple other things we do. We go to Congress. I was at the White House the other day chatting it up with the people from the real West Wing. And trying to get them to not cut this line item for planetary science. I know to you, $309 million is what?
Right.
It's Starbucks. Right.
Yeah. Well, I work on the internet and cable. So
it just rolls in. Yeah. But this line item over the next five years would be a disaster for planetary exploration. And we might lose this expertise that nobody else has, and that is the ability to land on another world. It's quite
so. What is the main goal of sending these organisms to Mars, just to see what the effect?
Well, for the concerned viewer, we're not sending them to Mars itself.
Okay.
We're sending them to Phobos, a moon of Mars.
Okay.
And even if I can talk all mathy on you, even at 9 sigma, this is 9. Standard deviations from the mean, it would not hit Mars. So very, 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 very unlikely to hit Mars. But the idea was to go to Phobos, scrape up some Phobos, and come back. And so everybody agreed. Well, first of all, I talked to the planetary protection officer at NASA.
Just there to make sure somebody. We're not bringing something back?
Well, no, that would be fine. It's the don't want to contaminate Phobos. Do not want to violate the prime the prime directive, can't interfere.
That's so, true. Until so, they have warp drive.
The officer said, well, you don't even need to run that test. They're going to be, those microbes are going to be fine. You don't even need to do that. This is going to be fine. I mean, you can do it by analysis. They're going to be fine. That's when I realized it was a good idea. they hadn't thought of it. There was just a mission to this extraordinary place in the solar system, and we could get a piggyback.
Cut to a sentient water bear planet.
Yes. Sentient? Is that the first one?
They thrive.
Except
they turn into a weird
water
bug planet.
If you see them like with a hand lens with a little magnifier, they're very happy.
Yeah.
They're not mean.
Well, they would get more aggressive because of the radiation.
Well, so that's it. So everybody agrees the cold would probably be no big deal. The organism freeze-dried and sealed up in super secret thing in our patented living interplanetary flight experiment, acronym LIFE. Patented biomodule, and they're in Delrin, you know, super plastic things. But the cold wouldn't bother them, the zero gravity wouldn't bother them. Everybody, the unknown thing is the radiation. That much deep space radiation, that many cosmic rays, that many solar windy things. What would happen? Anyway, the thing's in the Pacific Ocean, so we have to wait for another ride to this extraordinary place. But our members support this kind of kooky stuff. That's what's so cool.
Yeah.
And then we now have an educational effort that we are mounting because Uncle Bill's here, and you know he's all about education. So we educate, we advocate.
You trailed off a bit during the education part.
Yeah. Well, we create projects. Like we try to get a microphone on Mars. We tried.
For an open mic.
Four times. Well, there'd be no restriction.
For a Steve Martin look-alike contest.
No, but if you show up, if you're a Martian and you show up, introduce yourself, Slate, as we say in acting.
You bring two people, you go up early.
It's a bringer show, Martian bringer show.
Okay, but let me just, a concern. The Spirit and Opportunity rovers have gone now since 2004. So way past, you know, their intended life. So the mission now, all in, is over $1 billion. Then the Curiosity rover, probably $4.5 billion, I think, all in. How much do you think, Emily? Two billion? $2 billion all in. So anyway, we're about $3 billion all in. And those rovers are not even locked. Okay, anybody on Mars can just walk up to them. I mean, come on, people. You talk about open mic, they're going to steal the, you know, they're going to walk off with the thing.
We got to send up some U-locks.
Mars is a...
In a chain link fence.
The club.
Mars is a bad neighborhood.
Mars is it's bad for us, yeah. As far as we know. Ultraviolet light, crazy cold, extraordinarily dry. Like,
yeah.
Dry like you don't know.
So, what's our goal with Mars, though? I mean, like, we're not going to colonize Mars
friends,
anytime
soon. My friends. Friends.
Yes. We're getting close.
Are you trying to think of something to say?
There are two questions.
Okay.
That have troubled us all. And if you have not asked these two questions, I say, check out.
All right.
Take the black capsule. Can I have your car? Because you're going to the bridge and you're out. All right. You can... okay. Where did we come from?
Mm-hmm.
And are we alone?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now in your mind's head, we are walking along in Antarctica, and what are we doing? We're minding our own business, right? And there's a rock on, it's dark, on the great expanse of marsh of Antarctic white,
mm-hmm.
Right? So you pick up, you might first examine the rock. If you're a geologist, probably take some pictures, think, you know, radio back to base. So there's no mountains anywhere. There's no rock outcropping anyplace, and it hits you. I hope not this specific one. It occurs to you that the rock got here from space. It's the only way it could be on the ice in Antarctica. Got here from space. Then you, ever so careful, plastic bag, like picking up after your dog. You pick it up, and you take it back to the lab, and you look at it really closely, and you see this pattern of shock in the rock from an impact. You take it to, let's say, Huntsville, Alabama, where they have a vacuum chamber with the stainless steel crack open the rockmobile claws, and tiny bubbles of Martian atmosphere come out. gases that match the Martian atmosphere exactly. So this rock is from Mars. So imagine Mars, by the way, was quite wet. We know this from our rovers and scooping around and scraping and thinking, picturing and deep thoughting and photometric calibration targeting, that Mars was extremely wet in ancient times. It is possible that life started on Mars. Mars gets hit with an asteroidical thing. Less than 20,000 years, lands on Earth, and we are all descendants of that microbe. We are all really Martians. So, check
last
it out.
Last time anyone saw Bill.
We can learn this, or we can take the next step to making this discovery or investigating this hypothesis. For one trip to the fancy coffee store every 15 years per taxpayer. One cup of coffee per taxpayer to every 12 years, and you can make this investigation. Come on, people. This is what great governments do. This is what great societies do. This is what we commit our intellect and treasure to.
And so
this is what we're doing. I'm pounding on the echoing table.
How do we prove, like, what? Let's say we are able to go to Mars, and like, then how do we verify this information?
Well, I mean, this is the next question. Suppose the Curiosity rover has the ability, from my understanding, by interviewing the head guy, to detect sterols. And we all know what sterols are. Well, I don't, but these are the chemical that would be left over after ultraviolet zapping for centuries, millennia, of cholesterol. So it has, theoretically, the ability to detect evidence of ancient life.
Wow.
But that's probably not what it'll do. It'll do some cool geology and find a source of water, or learn more about the interaction of water in the Martian rocks. And we will learn more about what happened to all the water that was on Mars. So it is my little dreamy ween that we go to some equatorial place where it's kind of right around freezing of water on Mars, get an outcropping where the super, super salty Martian water is oozing on a Martian summer day, and there will be Mars crobes still alive. But then we'd want to know, do they have DNA? Are they like us? Or are they a whole nother thing? Or is there nothing on Mars, which is, makes our place in space even more unusual?
Would it be... I always wonder, like, yeah, there could be life on other planets, but is it life that we would even recognize as life?
Well, if it's a bacterium. You know, when I was young, it was taught in school heavily. You had to live on the Earth's surface to be a living thing. You had to be a plant. Or if you were a sea creature, you had to rely on phytoplankton, plants in the ocean, right? Or if you didn't eat the plankton, you ate stuff that ate the plankton, that ate stuff that ate the stuff that ate the stuff, and so on. But in my lifetime, people wandering around on the bottom of the ocean, apparently, from what I understand on some classified thing for mapping the seafloor for submarines, discovered this whole ecosystem at the bottom of the freaking ocean where there's no sunlight. Freezing, crazy cold. Salt water corrosively crushing. As we say, ocean exploration is difficult. It's crushing, it's corrosive.
And it's anaerobes, too. Like
yeah, the whole thing. And so Robert Ballard, the guy who discovered the Titanic.
And the Bismarck.
Comes up, slits the thing open, and he says it smells like sulfur and it looks like meat. It looks like red meat, these clams. It's crazy. And anyway, there are bacteria that live in nuclear reactors. Like, you would think, as a human, you'd think it's kind of inhospitable. I mean, all the jokes you want about the
super... Or a Vulcan.
Yeah, yes. Apparently they're good with the radiation.
Yeah, well, they die and then you just send them to another planet. And they
Oh, yeah. That's
they have to go through Pond Farr.
That was later on. Yeah. The blood fever.
Are you going through Pond Farr right now?
No, I've
Are
done
you a lot. Taking a mate?
No, I go swing dancing. It happens a lot. this intrigue, the promise of these discoveries is what drives us in space exploration. Space exploration is humbling in the sense that you discover pretty quickly that you're an insignificant nobody. You know, you're just a speck. You're no different from a grain of sand, as I always say. You're just a speck on the earth, which is another speck, orbiting specks within specklessness. But that we can understand that is astonishing and
worthy. What do we do with that knowledge? What if tomorrow you're like, somehow I can go to Mars. I've discovered the answer to this question. Problem solved. We are Martian in origin. Now what?
What was the origin of that?
Well, that's the next question.
Keep going.
If, as I say, if you're not troubled by that. But don't you think we learned something practical?
Well, sure.
So I'll give you an example. People used to think the sun went around the earth.
Yeah.
And I'm not joking you. And they did extraordinary navigation with this model, with this mathematical model.
Sure.
Because it was worked out in great detail. These guys drove all over the Mediterranean Sea because they knew the position of every island, every seaport, everything with respect to what we nowadays call the apparent sun, the motion of the sun through the sky. But we discovered that that's a pretty good model, but not good enough. And the actual truth is the Earth goes around the sun, and this is what enables navigation. All the food you ever eat, let alone every internet phone call you've ever made. Well, I mean, without global positioning satellites, none of this would be possible. You wouldn't have global positioning satellites if you couldn't navigate and understand the Earth. So as we say, we undertake these expeditions of exploration because we don't know what we're going to find. We don't know what's over the horizon. That's why we're going, people. What are you going to find there? We don't know. That's why we're looking. And so we say all the time, when you explore, two things will happen. You will make discoveries. If you explore your backyard, you're going to discover. I mean, the word discovery, you know, potato salad bugs roll up. Wow, I remember making that discovery. Crazy. But you will also have an adventure. You will have an adventure. And this is what drives us. This is what makes humans humans. And my claim, from an evolutionary standpoint, if you were an ancient human and you were not driven to explore, if you did not look over the hill or past the horizon, you probably disappeared.
Yeah.
Other entities, like your fellow tribesmen who did were imbued with that desire, took your stuff, pushed you down and took your stuff. If I may quote A. Whitney Brown.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Classic.
A. Whitney Brown. They say the meek will inherit the earth. I hope they do. Because I'll push them down and take it. And then he said, even a wimp can kick a meek's ass. Using the term meek as a noun, a meek, you can push down a meek. This is funny. God, A. Whitney Brown, I cry laughing just thinking about that guy.
Who else did, what other comedians did you like?
Well, I was telling these young people about this the other day. Jerry Seinfeld used to come through Seattle on the comedy circuit, you know, all these guys did. And guys like John Keister.
Sure.
And Ross Schaefer, who was the original host of the show.
Yeah, yeah.
And Jeff Stilson, who went on to become the producer of The Osbournes. He was Chris Rock's head writer. A guy of European descent from Spokane, Washington, became Chris Rock's head writer.
Yeah, Jeff Stilson had the great the bowling joke about commentating bowling. What do you think he's going to do this shot? I think he's going to try to knock down those pins, Bill. That's what I would do.
My roommate is a Buddhist. He doesn't believe in death. He doesn't believe that things die. Well, he's obviously never owned an aquarium. Anyway, these guys would come through town. All right, and Jerry Seinfeld came through, and this was in the early days. He carried a tape recorder in his sport coat pocket, like the early cassette recorders that were small enough.
The mini cassette recorder?
Yeah, pin light battery kind of thing. And he would record his show every night. And then you'd meet him for brunch on a Sunday, and he was nice, you know, he's very nice to us, you know, the local guys. And he would go through every joke. And a guy at that level, you know, would have 200 jokes in an hour. 200, you know, punch words,
yeah,
let's say, in an hour. And he would evaluate every one of them. And that's how you get to that level, right? Yeah. You know, it is, and
these kind of a science-y approach to stand-up.
Kind of science-y. And so I would be, you could, with all due respect to my fellow comedians, whom I met many over the years, and if I'm including myself as a comedian, which could be a stretch,
yeah,
but not everybody had that discipline, and not, yeah, everybody made it that far. And I middled, can I, right?
Yep.
Yeah, but that's as far as I got. It's just too hard. Like, you headline, right?
I do.
It's really hard.
I admire
you. Way to go, man.
Oh, please. Bring it back to Steve Martin. There's a great... I back at you. There's a... But in Steve Martin's play, Picasso at the Pinocchio, he does the...
The Swift Rabbit.
Very nice.
Well...
He has this great concept where it's a... it's Picasso and Einstein, and they both go... They both, like, draw... Like, Picasso paints something. Like, they're in a contest. Picasso paints something really fast. And then Einstein draws a form, like he writes a mathematical equation, and then Picasso looks at Einstein's thing and he goes, "That's just a formula." And then Einstein looks at Picasso's painting and goes, "So is that."
Yeah.
And it's just like this really great idea that there's so much, you know, I feel like there's so much science in art, but there's a tremendous amount of art in science at the same time.
And this brings me to something I'm so into now, and I don't worship the guy, but wrote... The Outliers, Malcolm Gladwell,
yeah.
Yeah, but this is a heck of an idea, the 10,000-hour idea. If it's not 10,000 hours...
To become an expert.
Yeah. It's just that Steve Martin spent so much time on stage. Picasso made so many sketches that after a while, you get pretty good at it. You know, it's just an extraordinary amount of time.
But also the idea that everyone kind of has their go-tos. Like, no matter how, like, even if you're watching...
That's a formula.
Even if you're watching improv... It's like, but there's still, like... Yeah.
Okay. Did you know George Miller? Speaking of old comedians. He was buddies with David Letterman. He'd be on Letterman all the time. And this is... We're talking about old comics. George Miller, you know, he had... I think he had cancer, but he just took all kinds of pills. And, you know, at the height of his powers. But one of George Miller's things was improv... A notch above charades. So I will say, once in a while in improv, you get a great idea, right?
Yeah.
And it's very good for people to get stage time. But I don't want to shock any audience members of improv. A lot of it isn't that great, you know? And this is, you're a comedian, right?
Yeah.
I mean, guys like Jerry Seinfeld worked and worked on every joke, timing of every joke.
Timing.
I make my living with language. But I meet people, who can't express themselves. And I've always thought people who don't have a way with words sort of
It's so funny. Language is the best. I think you know what I'm trying to say.
God, I'm sorry, I just have such reverence for that guy.
I guess I wouldn't have anything anymore for my lucky astrology mood watch.
And so, like so many educated people, Steve Martin really, he's not a professional scientist, but he really believes in science, and he's very skeptical of traditional charlatan-style things.
Sure.
Astrology, palm reading, with psychics, and then I think ultimately, I'm not trying to shock anybody, you become skeptical of most mainstream religions, most organized religions. And along that line, I was Humanist of the Year.
Oh.
And I was on stage with Michael Shermer the night before us, and you know, I don't know if you know him, he's the skeptic. He's the editor of Skeptia, but he's got a great line. I'm attributing this to Michael Shermer, and it's not my line, but he points out that he is a militant agnostic.
That's funny.
I don't know, and you don't know either. Which is pretty good.
You don't know.
So what happens to scientists, you go to a church is good, it's moving and stuff, but when you compare that to the cosmos, to space, and that you are this guy with a brain this big, and one of my favorite jokes, my old boss's brain quite a bit smaller. Anyway, with your brain, you can understand all that. And that really is, fills you with reverence. That is a whole nother level of commitment.
Yeah.
And you kind of come to that after a while when you spend time, especially with astronomy. It's just, you know, it's billions and billions, this thing. No, he's not kidding. I mean, it really is an unimaginable number of stars.
Just really quickly before we wrap this up, because
with me, really quickly,
listen, we have that time for 5 hours.
An issue with me.
Not at all. What was? I know you said you weren't like best buds with Carl Sagan, but what was he like?
He was just like that. Okay, I had his glasses in the 1970s.
During, that was a time?
Yes, during the disco era.
Yep.
Or if I may, the first disco era. The young people are trying to relive it, which, all things in moderation, people, let me say. But, except, of course, what?
Cocaine.
No. I did not know that. The audio guy's laughing. But that was, the joke is moderation.
Yeah.
Cocaine. Is that what's motivating all of you? See, I'm high on life, people. I really believe in this. So, we got a snort from Chris. Wow.
Yeah, my second snort.
Way to go.
Second snort.
Anyway, Carl Sagan was just this fantastic presenter. I mean, he was a dramatist. I mean, he would routine his lectures, you know, how to say, second funniest, third funniest, first funniest. I mean, he was terrific. He was all that. Then, when I started out with the success of the Science Guy segments on this comedy show, I went to him. I made an appointment, which was a big deal. He was at the height of his powers, covers of Newsweek, PBS special, Cosmos also. And his assistant, I'm almost sure her name was Olivia, set me up, or Olive, set me up. And he was very gracious, and he said, don't do technology, focus on pure science. And the verb he used, kids resonate to pure science. And I was working at a company in Redmond, Washington, where Microsoft is now, in Seattle area. I mean, it's not the area. It's next to Seattle. It's the next zip code. And I just felt that the people I was working for were very short-sighted. And I wanted to affect kids so that we would one day have scientifically literate people to, dare I say it, change the world. And so,
mission statement, first paragraph.
It's the mission statement. Well, it really is. I mean, it's really the idea. And if you think about your favorite teacher, everybody had a favorite teacher, right? What made that teacher so compelling was his or her passion. It's the passion. And when I tell you, Carl Sagan had the passion. And then now, I'm pretty good friends with his widow, Andrian. It's pretty good, you know, she's an acquaintance. And they are believers, and he was really nice to me. And just to talk some more briefly about, he wrote me a letter. Dear Bill, you know, I watched when I was in Seattle, leaves out the part dying of cancer, I did watch your show. You know, it doesn't suck. He said it's quite good or something. It's very nice. I don't think he said doesn't suck, but I think I found a few conceptual errors. And you know, with the sky, you said that the sky is blue makes the ocean blue. That's not really true. The ocean absorbs in the red, and this is. And when you get a letter like that from Carl Sagan, you either A, ignore it, or B, blow your brains out. No, I did not blow my brains out.
Okay.
I wrote him back. Actually, Professor Sagan, the color of the sky does affect the color of the ocean, and I sent him 11 pictures. He just hasn't spent enough time at sea. That's what I would do. No, seriously.
You schooled Carl Sagan?
I did. And the skeptics thought that was great stuff at the skeptic meeting. But after that, he had great respect for me.
The next letter, dear bitch. Thanks for the pictures.
Oh, no, but the letter to me had a little bit of that. I think I found a few conceptual errors. You know, it had a little tone, but after that, it was really good.
That is an amazing. But I have to say,
and you get a letter from the Center for Radio Physics.
And that's
that
what's
is.
So genius about science is that when it with science, it doesn't matter who you are, the facts ultimately.
Oh,
when that Carl Sagan in the last moments of his life could write your letter, you could write back and go, Actually, it's
that was
this.
Cool.
He did respect that.
He really did, and it still means that I get choked up. It means a lot to me.
Did you save the letter? Is it Frank?
No. Yes, I saved the letter. Yes, I saved the letter. But along this line, my young people, my Facebooking obsessed, my foursquaring, my Twittering, crowdsourcing turned up to 11 colleagues. Crowdsourcing is really good at some things. Wikipedia, for example, is great at some things. And I was at the TED deal this year, and they brought out a bull on stage, an animal. They're big, mm-hmm. by my standards. And the crowd, by texts, guessed the weight of the bull. And they got within a kilo. They got within 2 pounds. It's a fantastic demonstration.
Wow.
Fantastic demonstration. But if you ask people why the earth has seasons, this in this one example, and you crowdsourced it, you'd probably get the wrong answer. People would say because the earth goes farther from the sun in the winter, but that's not it. And to your point, science is not a crowdsourced thing. If everybody thinks the ocean is blue because it always blue because it always absorbs red light, you wouldn't quite have it right. And this is just what you're talking about. If you make a scientific discovery that goes in the face of everything else, but it's a true discovery and it really is right, eventually scientists and the scientific community will, everybody in the world will come along to your point of view. It's quite a...
For a while, they'll just think you're a kook.
Oh, that's right. Well, and then it disagrees with the Bible. That's very popular. But after a while, this is in Western cultures that use it, by the way. But after a while, if it's true, it will come to the surface. And that's a remarkable and wonderful thing about science. And this is what leads me to always claim science is the best idea people have ever had. And people have had a lot of ideas.
Not all of them great, but this
that's what
great.
I say. But that and then through the process of science, if you don't like the idea that science is the best idea, we'll throw it out and come up with a better one, and we would say, well, that's the process of science.
Bristol Pepsi.
Science!
Right. Yeah. Yes.
Two good ideas.
Well, we're sort of at the end of our podcasting part, but is it all right to we show us around the Planetary Society a little bit?
Oh, yes, sure.
And will you please tell everyone to enjoy their burrito? That's something we say at the end of the podcast.
Enjoy your burrito.
Nice.
Hey,
that was a good one.
Yeah.
Maybe the best one.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by GoToMyPC.com. Go to MyPC.com, click the Try It Free button, and enter the promo code Nerdist.
Murder on My Mind, a new podcast available exclusively on Wondery Plus, explores the circumstances leading up to the murder of two young men and the mistrials of the man accused of killing them. Up-and-coming rapper YNW Melly gained notoriety in the hip-hop world for his shocking lyrics and criminal exploits. When two of his best friends were gunned down in a drive-by shooting, investigators suspected the young rapper staged the scene. But after not one, but two trials that ended in hung juries and new evidence that may place YNW Melly at the scene of the crime, his trial has been paused indefinitely. With countless twists and turns, Law & Crime covers all angles of the case and begs the question, is this young artist the victim of a witch hunt or a silver-tongued devil who's evil to the core? Listen to Murder on My Mind exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.